and we'll begin. For those of you who are just joining the group, and for the sake of those who listen to the tape without reference to the earlier ones, a little bit by way of introduction. I'm Roger Field from Minneapolis area, work in the national offices of the American Lutheran Church, but I'm an American cultural historian by training. And this week we've been working with some themes about the American mind and the witness of the gospel, and have been working with them on the basis of the history of some of our current powerful ideas and motifs. We have in earlier sessions talked something about the ambivalent European connection that Americans have, whether we are in fact transplanted Europeans with strong ties, or refugees from Europe trying to minimize the ties. We've talked about the powerful pull of the frontier and the idea of the new land and what that has meant in terms of our sense of independence and unlimited opportunity. We talked about a Puritan cluster of ideas, not the whole cluster, but the part that talked about a people who started out to be a new Israel in a promised land, who tried to build a very ambitious and very disciplined community, and who found that the frontier and the polity of congregationalism inevitably watered that down and made a kind of watered-down Puritanism into the civil religion of the land. And then yesterday we talked about the tension between the needs for independence and the needs for community that have characterized the American experience in the years since then. Now today we're going to go at a different cluster of ideas somewhat related to yesterday, the myth of the self-made man and the progressive vision. Let's begin in prayer. Lord Jesus, we ask you to help us somehow to get hold of the need to have the welfare of each one be the concern of everyone. We ask you to sort out for us those things in our common inheritance which are prejudicial to the needs of the poor, the lonely, the suffering. Help us to sort them out and purge from our own thinking those things which work against your designation of us as body of Christ. For we ask it in your name. Amen. Just a word again about books, because some of you are joining the group for the first time, and I'd like to just suggest two pieces of background reading, both of which are available in the bookstore. The key one is Martin Marty's book, Righteous Empire, written for a bicentennial series. It has as its only limitation that it deals with only the last half of American experience, the half from the Revolutionary War to the bicentennial in 1976. But except for that, and he's the one who identifies that limitation, except for that, very powerful book about the Protestant experience in America and what has happened to the early Protestant intentions, where we are now as churches as compared with where some of our forebears intended the church to be in the American experience. The other one is H. Richard Niebuhr's by now rather old book, Christ and Culture. By the way, the covers that you'll see up there are different because it's a later printing. H. Richard Niebuhr, who simply reminds Americans that there is more than one way to organize a church, that the congregationalism of Protestant experience is only one of five major types, and that at least two other pieces have been tried or are being tried by substantial portions of the Protestant community in this country, and that the Roman Catholics who came to this country brought a particular pattern also. It's a good perspective book because it helps you to say, yes, this is the way we do it, but there are other ways. So I commend them to you. Now, to today's subject. I want to work through the first part of it, lay it open for discussion. The last part is the kind that can easily be carried over to next week, so I have no burning need to deliver the whole thing today. Yesterday we looked at the problems created by a nation that has defined individualism as the right to work and live without interference, so that we then have viewed community requirements as necessities to improve human freedom, rather than seeing community as central to the meaning of life. Today, we take two more related but partly conflicting ideas and similarly track them down through our history: the myth of the self-made man and the progressive vision in America. Let me stop to say a word about myth for those of you who didn't hear me define that earlier. There are lots of kinds of myths, but I'm working with a particular kind, the so-called enabling myth. An enabling myth is the kind that a group or nation adopts that has a core of reality. There is some truth about it. It has a basis in fact. But because it happens to be so convenient to a particular emerging agenda, the group or nation takes that basis of fact, elaborates it, idealizes it, rounds it out, and declares more to be fact than really is fact, because the declaration of that greater fact enables the group or the nation to do what it sees it wants to do. The myth of the self-made man is that kind of an enabling myth. Let me see if I can sketch it. There was for every immigrant an economic dimension to the decision to come to the new world. There was no way to avoid asking the question, how shall I make a living, or can we live at all in the new world? But beyond that, for many, if not most immigrants, economic issues were the only reason for coming. We talk a lot about the Puritans because it was their ideas, their set of ideas, that became so dominant. Among them, an economic question was only one of several questions. But for most immigrants, the economic question was the question. So people came to this land expecting not only to survive and subsist, but to prosper. They had come to live better, not worse, or not even the same. Nearly all of them believed, and often rightly so, that the old world had hampered them in terms of economic fact, that it had denied them decent opportunity to work, or, if they had the opportunity to work, it had robbed them of their just rewards for their labor. It had minimized labor and maximized the opportunities of those who already had all the advantages. So they came to this world believing that they could succeed on their own, and I'm underlining the phrase on their own, because that's a crucial piece. In old England, there was already that idea that honorable people willing to work hard would get ahead. The problem was that old English idea had not been matched by English opportunities in the 17th century. They came with the idea to a land that they believed would let them actually try that idea. They had also heard this, though. It was not just that they came with that kind of inner yearning and the belief that they could make it on their own, but they had also heard it in a good deal of preaching, particularly, again, in Puritan preaching, though pulpits on the continent and in Anglican churches said some of the same thing. Namely, what they heard was that wherever one was willing to work hard, save, invest, there God was pleased and would bless the venture. God was selectively demonstrated from Scripture to be in favor of hard work and saving and investment. And for the Puritans, wealth was seen as a sign of God's favor. In fact, they came very quickly to say, if you have truly been elect among the elect, one of the signs of that will be that you will prosper. Conversely, if you are poor and stay poor, it probably means that you are not one of the elect, or else it means that you are simply not practicing the virtues, hard work, thrift, investment, one of the virtues that God has encouraged. Unless you want to discuss it later, I'll just allude to Max Weber's famous study, Protestantism and the Spirit of Capitalism, where the argument is that, in fact, the reformers, either accidentally or on purpose, wove into the Reformation, Calvin particularly, wove into the Reformation, themes that embodied individualism and selective advancement, that made capital and investment and interest a good thing, whereas medieval Roman Catholicism had called it usury and had condemned it. You remember all of the running battles between the de Medicis and the Fugger family about money to run the Roman Empire and all that sort of thing. Usury was a bad thing by medieval standards, so capital didn't accumulate, especially not investable capital. But Max Weber would argue that Calvin, in a great way, and Luther to some extent, embraced the idea that hard work and the fruits of labor were things to be coveted and enjoyed. Puritanism then had a bias toward the strong, toward the self-reliant, toward the shrewd but honest man. And I want to underline that shrewdness business. To be shrewd did not mean to be crafty, precisely, and it certainly didn't mean to be devious. What it meant was to be always watching for the opportunity. I was trying to remember which is the brokerage firm that shows this guy who gets up before anybody else. Is it Bache & Company? Yeah. That's an almost immoral commercial. It picks up that shrewdness business. This is the guy who sacrifices his late night to read corporate reports and gets up earlier than everybody else, and he's sitting all alone on that Long Island commuter train so that he gets to the office down on Wall Street before anybody else does. That's the kind of shrewdness piece. Take native ingenuity and then decide to really keep your eye open for the options. That's Puritan. That's preached Puritanism, not just kind of sacralizing what was going on. They had their explanations for failures, namely you were either lazy or you were out of favor with God, so they didn't even have to worry about that. They also tended to forget that they had left behind most of their social liabilities, that those who came to this country left behind the aged, the infirm, the inept, the cautious persons, the war debtors, and the war debts, military obligations, and the like. They were freed of all that stuff. They left it behind. And as a result, they had a lot of room to expand. As long as they gave themselves permission to expand, that's the intellectual content, and as long as they constructed a system that would allow them to expand. Throughout the colonies, the folk wisdom of the Benjamin Franklin type pushed success as it was measured in money and property. And it is Franklin who coins the phrase, God helps him who helps himself, and that really is the epitome of the public theology of the relationship between God and work and prosperity. So the pressure was on, from colonial days on, to find a useful secular employment, work, save, invest, because it was that combination that would succeed. It was not work, spend, and be at leisure, but work, save, and invest. That would be the hallmark of success. They were also taught not to be a burden to others, carry your own weight, and they insisted that others not be a burden to them, except when that burden was from an act of God, which they defined as being massacred by the Indians or having a drought or a plague. Why those were acts of God, but the rest weren't, is a very strange piece. Other than that, though, they did not intend to help others, and they did not intend to be helped. They were to be involved in self-help, and if everybody did that, the society would all progress. Let me try to illustrate the successive models of the myth of the self-made man. And again, for those of you who didn't hear me say it earlier, you just will not get the founding fathers, either the colonial ones or the revolutionary ones, to talk in any way about the self-made woman. Women were not supposed to self-make. They were supposed to be attached to a self-made man. And there just is no room there for any kind of sense of the equality of the sexes. Not surprisingly, the first model of the self-made man in the colonies was the merchant or the entrepreneur, the enterprising person. To some extent, that's farmers, but surprisingly, in the very earliest modeling of the ideal self-made man, the small farmer was not part of the ideal. It was primarily the merchant or the entrepreneur, and there was a certain shape of the life history of those who were considered the models. This ought to be someone who was born to simple means. The whole business of wanting to elect to high office people who were born in log cabins is a piece of that. And sometimes they invented log cabins or made them sound more humble than they really were. But someone born to simple means, preferably born on the farm, but making it in a merchant or enterprising kind of setting. And they should make it not by education. It wasn't that they were anti-education, but they didn't have much by way of schools and had not put much store by that yet, but primarily by working, by shrewdness, sometimes by luck. But the self-made man ought to be born simple and make it all on his own using only energy, industry, and commitment. And Benjamin Franklin ranked as the first symbol of the self-made man. Now that's of course very late in the American experience, but Franklin is the first one who emerges as kind of the folk hero of the whole seaboard rather than just known in a particular colony. You may recall there was precious little conversation between the colonies prior to about 1750. So nobody could emerge as the hero of the whole seaboard earlier than that. Franklin is seen as having been born in humble circumstances. He has happened to be at least in the city, in Boston. But he had the wit and the wisdom to leave home, in this case to go to another city, Philadelphia, to apprentice himself into a printing industry, to become the owner of a printing industry, to branch out and develop specialties in other areas. They could look past some of his shenanigans because, after all, he had succeeded. He was a marvelous symbol. That worked for a while, but as soon as a few years after the Revolutionary War, the rich persons on the Eastern Seaboard started to be people who had inherited their wealth. And it was never part of the myth of the self-made man that you were anything if you had inherited. You had to make it yourself. You had to start from scratch. And so very quickly, the myth moves westward and has to take on a new symbol because the Eastern Seaboard becomes seen as entrenched with its fortunes inherited and therefore as having lost the innocence and the vigor of the American dream. So it is the Westerners, by which they mean people on the west side of the Appalachians, Western Kentucky, Western Tennessee, bits of Ohio and West Virginia. That's the group, that's the area that starts to develop the second model of the myth of the self-made man. And now it really is agricultural. The second model is the yeoman farmer, the person who homesteads after he's been squeezed out of credit on the Eastern Seaboard, or after rich landholders have bought him out, or have bought up all the good land so all he could get was scrub land along the edges. And there are, by the way, just huge estates up and around the Hudson River, for example, down through the Carolinas. A few people ended up owning a lot of the land very quickly. So these people who said the dream of America was that each of us should own and be self-sufficient, we can't do that on the seaboard anymore, we'll move across the mountains. They became the homesteaders who desired only land on which to work and from which to be self-sufficient. That's an important piece to underline. Farming in those early days was not primarily to raise cash crops or exportables. It was primarily to be self-sufficient, raise only enough to sell, to buy only what you can't make for yourself. The rest of it was to be self-sufficient. That was the model. No farmer emerged as the person to personify that model. Instead, Andrew Jackson becomes the symbol. And that's a very strange symbol, because Jackson cannot be described as a yeoman farmer. He can be described as a lot of things: soldier, general, gambler, roustabout, an orphan who inherited a fair amount of money, who He used it in some interesting ways. He was a land speculator at times. But he managed by his own charisma to come to gather together the gripes, the hurts, the frustration of those men whom he had commanded in the War of 1812. He was their hero because he came to see the injustice of what was happening to them. If you've ever visited in Nashville at the Hermitage, which is Jackson's home during his later life, you know that he did not live plainly. It's a very interesting place. Not lush as compared to Monticello or Mount Vernon, but certainly not humble either. Andrew Jackson is the symbol. And he was the symbol not of the whole country, but of kind of the new wave, the people who were coming and trying to settle beyond the mountains, of the agrarian West over against the usurious old East. He was the champion of a group that had developed a conspiracy theory of what was going on in American society. Talked a little about that yesterday. That model survived for probably two generations, from roughly 1810 to roughly 1850, give or take, during which the yeoman farmer is the model. That's the ideal self-made man. If you wanted to live, if you wanted to be the ideal kind of person, that's what you did. But already there was coming across it another form of the myth of the self-made man as industrialization swept across the land. And that was that the new version that was emerging, the new self-made man, was not a farmer at all, but was a working man who started out as an apprentice in some kind of business or industry, sweeping the floors and filling the inkwells and running the errands, and then rose from there to become a captain of industry. That was typically the language that was used. Who rose to the very top by nothing but his own efforts, by proving that he was willing to work so hard and commit himself so thoroughly that the land of opportunity would lay opportunity in his lap. It was the rags to riches model, if you have heard that language. And one of the books I'm carrying around, I don't know if it's still in print, but it's a delightful thing. Irvin Wiley wrote a book called The Self-Made Man in America, The Myth of Rags to Riches. Very readable, not very long, 175 pages or so, just loaded with illustrations of what I'm about to say. The myth of rags to riches was that because this was a land of such great opportunity, anybody who really wanted to get ahead could. It was not a matter of having to take it away from somebody else. You didn't have to compete. There was plenty for everybody who was willing to try hard enough. That was a fairly naive assumption, but a fairly important one because it gave them permission to really gun for it and not worry about what happened to others. Horatio Alger is the one who makes this, symbolizes or romanticizes it the most. Horatio Alger was a Unitarian clergyman, found out there was more money in making speeches and writing biographies of the captains of industry. So he starts to pick the ones he wants to write about, and the ones he likes to write about sound like they just came ashore from a rowboat from over across the ocean. They wade ashore with nothing but their muscles to serve them, and they apprentice and they work their way up, and lo and behold, before they're done, it's an Andrew Carnegie or a Mellon or a J.P. Morgan or a Vanderbilt or a John D. Rockefeller. Not the ones who come a generation later, not the Henry Fords, for whom it's a different process. But that first wave, there were some rascals among them, Jay Gould and people like that, but they drew a distinction. It was not just getting rich. It was getting rich by doing it yourself and doing it honestly, and they always said fairly, though in retrospect it was hardly ever fair. But honestly in the sense that they weren't breaking the law or taking advantage of other people. Alger he paints the picture. He in effect says the people who have made it to the top all started at the bottom. Well, you don't have to be terribly smart to figure out what the message is to young people who are starting at the bottom. The message is, you know, get along, work hard, dedicate yourself to somebody of means, and maybe you can be somebody of means yourself. The clue was that they were licensed to think big, to turn every advantage, and to believe that what was happening when they succeeded was, and I'm quoting somebody else's phrase now, that character was triumphing over circumstances. They always believed that it was character that made the difference. Among other things, what that meant was that even the poor people in that society tended to celebrate the maldistribution of wealth because they tended to idealize the people who held such large blocks of wealth on their own. It's important to remember, by the way, that this is the time before there is either corporate tax or personal income tax, so that anything that was profit stayed in your pocket or stayed for you to use. And that's really an important piece. Popular mythology has it that in the later emigrations, let's say from 1870 on, popular mythology has it that as people started to come from Central and Eastern Europe and from the Mediterranean Ring, that they came with the same desire to live free, and that they were honorable people, sometimes naive, but honorable people who came. The truth is that about from 1870 on, there was a great deal of recruiting of immigrants by representatives of major American industries. The United States Steel, for example, had an agent full-time in Hamburg. That happened to be a major jumping-off point. One of the packing companies had in Chicago, I've forgotten which one now, had agents in several major Polish cities. It's no accident that it's Poles who settled parts of Chicago and Milwaukee. They were recruited by handbills in their own language that described the wonders of the New World, typically described how much they would be paid, but not how much it would cost to live, were given free passage. Now, just, of course, passage never did cost very much in those immigrant days. My grandparents said it cost them something like $75 for four of them to come over in 1890. But typically an individual, a young adult in steerage, could come over for $12 to $15. You had to carry your own food. You had to pack for that whole trip and cook for yourself. There was no such thing as common galley. But as long as you did that, passage itself didn't cost much. But from 1870 on, a lot of the immigrants were recruited and given free passage in return for their commitment to work for that particular industry for a set period of time at a wage that was already predetermined. And that's the kind of stuff that was going on, because they were being told the myth of rags to riches. It was a myth that had just enough basis to survive. What makes it doubly problematic from my point of view is that it was a myth that was given terribly strong public endorsement by churches and clergy. The preachers of what is called the gospel of self-help were primarily clergy. Later on, some of the captains of industry figured out how to preach it themselves, and they were preachers. If you've ever read any of Andrew Carnegie's later in life writings, or John D. Rockefeller's stern proverbs, they turned into preachers of this too. But early on, it was the people who already knew how to preach who adopted this new gospel of self-help and became the promoters of it. They were not, if Lutherans want to give ourselves some freedom, they were not primarily Lutherans, because Lutherans were not primarily using the English language yet. And in fact, most of our ancestors were just in the process of arriving. That only means that we were preserved from one of the fallibilities of the young nation. But clergy, the clergy who were the clergy of the day, the big churches, the public pulpits, these were the ones who really pressed this model. The one who gets credit for being the worst, usually, besides Horatio Alger, the Unitarian, is Russell Conwell. And Russell Conwell was a Congregationalist who developed a speech which he said he gave over 3,000 times, the title of which was Acres of Diamonds. And he had a famous illustration, and it has to do with an Englishman who was went to South Africa as a young person, and I've forgotten all the pieces of the story even now, but it has to do with the fact that the land that he had been working on and then had given up on. It turned out he had tried to be a farmer and it just didn't work for him. It turned out that later on they discovered the richest diamond mine in all of South Africa, right where he'd been trying to farm. And Conwell's language out of that was, you're standing on acres of diamonds. Anybody who comes to America is standing on acres of diamonds. All you have to do is work hard enough to find it. That was the church's endorsement of this sort of thing. Russell Conwell, by the way, founded Temple University later on with the money he made out of that kind of public speaking. This was the Chautauqua Circuit and that whole business, you know. I think it's Mark Twain who gave a different and much less hopeful title to the time. Where Conwell could talk about acres of diamonds, Mark Twain called it the Gilded Age, and when Mark Twain says gilded, that's not a compliment. He's talking about gold leafing some very base things, about kind of papering over the really ugly character of the time. I don't know how you read Mark Twain, whether you see him just as humorist and writer of adventure tales. Those who specialize in talking about the intentions of authors would say that Mark Twain is really a quite savage critic of the time. That he was trying to suggest that what was really going on was that the innocent were being taken for all they were worth by those who had long ago stopped being innocent, but who still kidded themselves that they were. The Gilded Age was a very tough time, a very ugly time. It's the time when railroads were given 20-mile right-of-ways. 20 miles each side of the track was given to railroads in certain places, certain whole states, gave them that much right-of-way just to induce them to lay track through there, at the same time that up until Lincoln's time, a homesteader could only get 80 acres, and then he had to get it so far away from the railhead that he couldn't get his produce to the railroad, and then it was only one railroad that had the monopoly. And so typically what he finally had to do was buy his farm from the railroad, from that 20-acre right-of-way, and then the railroad was willing to deal with his produce. That's the kind of time. It's a very ugly time. Another American writer, Vernon Lewis Parrington, calls it the Great Barbecue, and he says what it was that in theory everybody was invited, but in fact only some of them were ever allowed to come. Well, the Gilded Age finally gives way. And the model of the giant or the captain of industry, the rags to riches sort of thing, the self-help motif, has to be modified, because there comes a time when Carnegie can no longer run United States, his own private company, and it is incorporated and it develops a different kind of capitalist base. And one of the first things Carnegie has to do is to retire, and they bring in a different man, university trained. Happened to be a judge. They bring in someone who operates on a different kind of frame. Judge Gary, who is the first corporate head of United States Steel after Carnegie retires, Judge Gary is also the self-made man. He too started out poor. But in his case, the road to riches was not apprenticeship and then work your way all the way up through. His approach was you gather an education. You learn management in some allied kinds of areas, and then you're brought in over the heads of those who have worked in the foundries and throughout the industry. In other words, we have a different sort of person now. The self-made man is the one now who climbs the corporate ladder, or who is the managerial genius. Not the one with the great idea, but the one who knows how to manage a very large and complex thing. It's still important that he have humble origins, but now it's important that he have a good education, that he have corporate loyalties, which are transferable in case he moves from one corporation to another. And then in order to humanize him, he also, and this was already true of the captains of industry, he also had to have a benefactor strain in him. It was never taught that he was allowed to keep everything he earned. He was always supposed to use it for the good of the many. I have some difficulty when I go into a Carnegie library, because I've read enough about the history of United States Steel to know how many immigrants died for that money. But Carnegie's style was to tell himself that it was his obligation to develop some means by which others could self-help themselves. Never or almost never did they give for the feeding or the housing of the poor. That didn't fit with the myth. What fit was that you created more opportunities for others to make their way up the same ladder. So there are the libraries and the technical institutes, organizations like that that would allow people who had the drive to get there. Herbert Hoover becomes the model. If you've been tracking with me, we've gone from Benjamin Franklin to Andrew Jackson to the Carnegie types. Carnegie was the most flamboyant, so in some ways he was the one who was lifted out the most. Go to Herbert Hoover. He had all the right credentials. Born in a very humble cabin in West Bend, Iowa, orphaned at age 10, out of a Quaker background that believed in gentleness and honesty and thrift, becomes part of the first graduating class of Stanford University and works his way through. Nobody helps him. Makes a fortune as an engineer in South Africa, but is drawn back, having made his own fortune, I think $3 or $4 million, which by the standards of that time is a lot of money, is drawn back because he believes he's also called to be more involved in the welfare of others. So it's Hoover who catches the imagination. And in one of those strange ironies, it is Calvin Coolidge who is the prophet and Hoover who is the promised one. It's Coolidge who says the business of this nation is business, and it's Hoover who is elected on the platform that says, if the business of the nation is business, let's have a businessman. That's the kind of metamorphosis of the self-help mystique. In recent years, the whole idea of the self-made man is severely tried. It may be argued that there's been no prototype, no model since Hoover. I vacillate between saying that Franklin Roosevelt became the next model, that, in other words, that government man became the next model, or of saying we really didn't have a model. If you use FDR, you of course cannot argue the rags to riches thing. Just visit Hyde Park and take a look at that house and the grounds of that old Dutch estate up there. Roosevelt was born with a silver spoon in his mouth, to borrow that kind of phrase. But there are some other things. I left out one piece of the rags to riches thing. One of them was that invariably the captain of industry was, since he didn't inherit anything from his father, in fact, the best of all of Horatio Alger stories were the ones where the father died young, so it was a widowed mother and an orphan child. You know, that was marvelous. There was a piece of the myth that said what really gave these men their sense of character and purpose was that they were raised by strong-willed and honorable mothers. Well, if you take that piece of it, then FDR is some of that. If you know the story of his relationship to his mother as contrasted to his relationship to his wife, it's a powerful piece. And if you've ever been in Hyde Park and looked at the house, fascinating bedroom arrangement. FDR's bedroom is a big one with a big old high-top bed and that whole thing. Eleanor's bedroom is right next to it with a connecting door, and it's about half the size. And Mama's bedroom is right next and also has a connecting door. So Franklin could get to Eleanor from one side and Mama could get to her from the other. You know, that poor woman spent her whole life trapped between those two. And there was that sense. I don't know whether FDR is the next incarnation of the myth of self-help. I don't think so. I think what happened was that the myth got broadcast out into government, that what happened was by then we weren't dealing with the individual so much anymore as we were with what institution is it. That in some ways we went from mercantile institutions in Franklin's time to agriculture in Jackson's time to big industry and business in Carnegie's time to corporate affairs and high finance in the time of Hoover to government. That there's more of a movement of institutions than there is of persons, and that we are in an institutional kind of time, And if you want to carry it the next step, the problem right now is that we're not sure that any institution has the moxie to keep the American dream alive. You may want to come back to that in just a little bit. I think that in some ways, Willie Loman is the next hero, anti-hero, of the American dream. If you have read or seen Death of a Salesman, you remember that Willie, apparently his father deserted. That's the impression you get. He lives with his mother. Interesting how those pieces get woven in, you know. An uncle shows up and is on his way to make a killing in Alaska, and Willie is wants to go along, but he's not old enough, and he says to the uncle, "Will you send for me when you have made it in Alaska?" Instead of becoming what he wanted to be, Willie ends up being a lingerie salesman with the New England Territory for a particular company. And he never makes the kind of money that he says he makes. He lies through his teeth about how much money he makes. He keeps borrowing and refinancing. And finally, you know, Willie realizes how much he's died on the inside, and he can't live with it anymore, so he takes his old mortgage Studebaker and plows it into a bridge and kills himself. And Death of a Salesman is in some ways the end of the myth of rags to riches, or the myth of self-help. He was so driven by the need to succeed that he was unable to relate to those who wanted to love him the most. And when I see or read Death of a Salesman, the most poignant scene in the whole thing for me, maybe it's different for you, the scene for me is the one where after the funeral and a few days have passed, Linda, his wife, is out at the cemetery, and there's still the mound of dirt over his grave because it hasn't settled yet. And sobbing, she says to Willie, "I took the insurance money and made the last payment on the refrigerator, but I'd rather have had you back." You know, that's just a devastating kind of thing. If I do much more, we're not going to have time for discussion. So let me do two quickies. Just allude to them, and then I'll pick them up next time instead. It should not be surprising that in the 1870s, Americans who took the time to think or listen at all decided they could not accept Charles Darwin. Darwinism simply was not part of what they were willing to accept, even though it was precisely what they were practicing. It didn't fit the mindset. The mindset didn't talk about survival of the fittest. It talked about the prospering of the hardest working. So the idea that some people had natural advantages and that others were naturally disadvantaged simply was not acceptable. And Monday, when we go into the whole matter of the progressive mindset and that sort of development, I'll talk about social Darwinism, what we did to Darwin to turn it into something we could use. And then the other thing, and I'll just allude to it for now, the American scene could not accept the original version of Sigmund Freud. When Freud's materials were first brought to this country, the primary response was to declare that he was wrong, because he seemed to be talking about a different kind of determinism, an internally imposed one. That there were liabilities from birth, or liabilities particularly from environment, from family relationships. And that didn't fit the rags to riches idea either. People were not to be internally inhibited, nor externally disadvantaged. It was a land of equal advantage for all, depending only on those who were willing to work with it. I suspect you've made the intersections with the gospel already, but it won't hurt if I make them. You see, I'm passing some material on the way. The first and the worst fact about the myth of the self-made man as it intersects with the gospel, the first and worst fact about the myth is that it is mostly a lie. It just simply was never true. The second is that even those who did succeed paid a much larger social price for their success than they intended to, or believed they had paid. And typically the social price they paid was that they sacrificed their ability to relate and their solidarity with the rest of society. As I understand the gospel, by the way, you have to be very careful when American religious materials of the a great deal of American history talk about gospel. What they really mean is religious system, not gospel. When you talk about the gospel of self-help, that's a contradiction in terms. But as I understand gospel, the gospel tells us that one has lived and died for us, freeing us from the anxiety for our own existence. Therefore, we are called to live for others, especially the poor, the sick, the blind, the lamed. And what happens is that the American mind debases servanthood or interdependence almost precisely at the same time that the gospel encourages interdependence and servanthood for the sake of others. Next time I want to talk about the social gospel in relation to progressivism. I think that's enough for now. It's your turn.
Roger.
Yes.
I'm interested in your reflections on whether there's been now, within the last 6 months from the election campaign on, a resurgence of some of these themes. It may just be an association that the mind does sometimes, but when you said Gilded Age, the thing that came to my mind immediately was a new book by George Gilder entitled Wealth and Poverty. And David Stockman has been handing it out like people sell pencils on the street corner.
He says like jelly beans.
And it's evidently has captured more than the imagination, also the policy of the present administration. And I've only begun to read it, and I don't want to talk about the book. I want to talk about whether you think these themes have made a resurgence. But I've only begun to read it. The model in there is the risky the entrepreneur who will take risks, and it is given substance with the language of faith and morality. I mean, there is in quotation marks now a gospel that underwrites this new statement of what I think is an old theme of the entrepreneur as the model. And in fact, the place of women in that book is to kind of civilize the men who are to be aggressive.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Well. Okay. Several responses. First of all, yes, I do think that we are seeing the resurgence of an old idea that never really died. If in fact the Reagan people mean that there will be a safety net, then they are, in fact, arguing both self-help and social responsibility. I don't see enough evidence of the safety net yet. What I think is that that's being said to us to persuade us that it's all right to let the rest go. But we'll know soon after the 1st of October when 230 major programs are either totally phased out or dramatically cut back. We are clearly saying again, the right way for this nation to develop its strength and its integrity is for everybody to work and everybody to have to work, and that those who can't work need to be helped, but those who won't work do not deserve what they've been getting for a long time. Now, that's clearly here. I am, though, struck by another piece. I think it's possible that we overstate where Reagan is on that trajectory by mistaking what he stands for, by confusing what he stands for with what moral majority people stand for. Moral majority people, I perceive, are far more into that the middle class for itself and to hell with the rest of the world than Reagan is. I do not sense that with him. It is interesting and instructive to me that the two presidents whom he idealizes or uses as prototypes are Franklin Roosevelt and Calvin Coolidge. Normally, you wouldn't even hang their pictures in the same room. Very strange. Apparently, what he picks up from Roosevelt is it's time for a dramatic change. Take charge. Make things happen. and use the power of government to make them happen. Now, that really has more in common with the New Deal than it at first sounds like. The New Deal was a take-charge kind of thing. It is not time for business as usual. It's time for something dramatic. From Coolidge, though, he gets the idea that the dramatic thing to do is to get the government off the back of business so that business can do what it did to make this country great in the first place. It's a terrific gamble, and my sense is that it will fail because of all the social liabilities that we now cannot escape, which we did escape when we were an emigrant nation. When you no longer can leave the old and the sick and the terribly disadvantaged behind, when you can't shuck them off by leaving them in the old world, it isn't going to work the same. I don't know. That's just some random reflections.
Is it true that possibly one of the reasons the church, through many generations, was always so willing to preach and promote this rugged individualism is that the young man who was struggling to work and save and invest was to do that made it impossible for him to be morally degenerate.
Yes.
In other words, the young man that did these things but also did not drink or carouse and all those implications. And maybe that's where a lot of the appeal of the moral majority now is. Not so much that you're going to be either the super successful corporate person or maybe the small individual, but back to personal morality.
Yes, that's clearly there, and let me just try to document bits and pieces of that. During particularly the Gilded Age, from, say, 1870 to 1900, the model for self-development was that, first of all, you had to learn to read and write and so forth, but grade school was enough for that. They really didn't even push high school for young men, and certainly not college. College graduates were seen as having become so soft and degenerate in the process that they weren't going to be very much good. And that doesn't change until the financing patterns get so complex that you needed an education to get at them, to understand them. But education, by the route of formal schooling, first of all, they said it's not much good, and secondly, they said most of the poor can't afford it anyway. There has to be another way. The other way was self-help. You learn to read. Public school taught you to read, and you had to teach yourself to think, and then you read. It's no accident that Carnegie chooses libraries, because libraries were places where even the poorest could go and educate themselves. If you think of Lincoln and the way he trained himself for the law, you get some pieces of that. They also said, not only should you spend your spare time, and remember, we're talking normally about 6 12-hour days of work a week. That was the typical work week in those times. On top of that, and on top of living rather simply, you also, employers had no hesitation about requiring that their employees be church members and churchgoers. You ought to spend a couple nights a week at a library, at least one night a week at prayer meeting, twice on Sunday you ought to go to church, and then, as you say, that means there's neither time nor inclination for the depraving things of society. Yeah, you're very much right. That was a part of the style. Now, the moral majority gets caught on one piece of that agenda, though, and that is that they can only encourage that for men, because their other agenda has to do with the reassertion of the primacy of the family and of the woman's role in relation to children. So the moral majority is not pressing that with women. Their way out of that is to say, women were, after all, not as depraved to start with, so you don't have to worry about them so much.
Roger, one of the things that I see in Reagan's policies is pulling government out of where, at least he feels, it does not belong. And what this does is it opens up a lot of opportunities, you might look at it that way, for the church to get involved in many of these more humanistic things.
Yeah. There's no question but what that's true. And there's also no question but what we have neither the organization nor the resources to move into that with any kind of effectiveness. But what's going to happen to us is that so many of our own people, after all, it wasn't they who elected him, it was us. You know, that's an overwhelming electoral victory. The mindset that elected him is the same mindset that will stymie the church in attempts to try to be the champion of the poor or to develop the social services to replace governmental ones. We will run into a substantial barrier in the minds of people. That when I was on a bishop's staff, the most horrendous discussions I ever had about social welfare were in absolutely rural Nebraska congregations. And they were primarily with people who were handing out John Birch pamphlets at the doors. They didn't have any hesitation at all about saying, trouble with welfare is that it's treating no goods as though they were worth something. That's just so such a powerful piece that it's also going to infect what the church is able to do.
I think that the government has been very ineffective in handling some of these social issues. And I think that that's much of what many of the people that voted for Reagan have seen. It might be that they would look at the church as being potentially more effective in these areas.
Sure.
Wasn't it refreshing to land at Lucerne and discover that the forestry people that were working there were volunteers?
Did
any of you pick up on that?
Volunteerism, you know, has never died in this society, and it certainly will see some resurgence. And charitable concern never died, and we'll see some resurgence. But this is not going to be a very optimistic statement, but it tells you where I am. The question may not be whether government should do it or the private sector should do it. The problem may in fact be that it's undoable, that the American dream itself was unrealistic, that there is no way that human beings, as fractured as we are, will equitably divide what we have, and the attempts in purely communist settings, if there is such a thing as a pure communist setting, to equitably divide, founder on the fact that unless people have individual incentives, they don't produce much. It may be an insoluble problem. And in fact, the Stockman phrase about the safety net may better represent what we need to advocate both through church and governmental processes. And that is that at a minimum, we have an obligation to make sure that in an anonymous society, there are not those who die or suffer while the rest of us live well. I think that's what the safety net means. Go.
It seems to me that there may be another perspective to see some of this or to try to take advantage of what is very difficult and I think, as you accurately say, somewhat hopeless situation. Part of the reaction against in the election, if one believes the polls about people's attitudes, which don't in fact show any great turn to the right, but simply show a desire for some change, which I think the Reagan administration has vastly misinterpreted. Part of what one could say is that there is a fundamental distrust in the centering of power at the federal level for solving all these sorts of issues. And that the distinction is not between using government power or not using government power, but is finding appropriate places where government, where the role of government at all levels can be effective in dealing with particular social, environmental issues. And on that score, I think one can make an argument that we're not dealing with the quest towards community, being concerned with others, therefore giving power at a federal level, as opposed to believing in the myth of the self-made man, which means let it all go and it's every person for themselves, but that it might open up opportunities for neighborhoods, for small communities, for initiatives at state levels, and even more so at local levels, in which the church can, in fact, be very active,
yes.
in which
yes.
new forms of social caring, new forms of community can come about. I mean, you can make the argument that one reason why the community, in fact, doesn't make any sense when you interpret that as making the federal government the equalizer.
Yeah.
There have to be other avenues. Now, do you respond?
I would pick up what Lauren Halverson said yesterday. The thing that beggars that is the matter of scale. If, in fact, people didn't move so much, and if, in fact, a primary community was small enough so you could know everyone, I think there is enough honor in us that we could be appealed to make sure that nobody grossly suffers in that community. I think that's a viable, workable kind of thing. New England town meetings suggest that it was. But the problem is that the mobility creates anonymity, and the scale of the urban societies just simply dwarfs the efforts. There's time for one more.
I have a comment.
Yes. Go.
I'm wondering how much sick roll and chronic disability enter into that. For example, in the self-made man, if we're all supposed to do our thing, it's okay to be sick because you'll get better. And that's part of the sick roll. You want to get better and you want to be productive. But now we have a problem with chronic disability, the chronically disabled elderly or the chronically ill or the mentally retarded who will never get better.
Yeah.
Who will never, you know, and I think that we have a bit of a problem with that. We don't really know what to do with them, so we see them as being, they don't fit into society. I think that's a problem.
I think it is, too. They never fit into the myth. They never fit into the ideal. But people always had to deal with them in practice. Mm-hmm. And so there have been a variety of different ways of trying to deal with people who are genuinely disadvantaged or disabled. But they never fit into the ideal. They should not have existed from the point of view of the ideal. And it's that should not have existed piece that's such an issue. Well, what I hope I've said today is to beware of the gospel of success. Beware of it as a personal goal, because it's a very lonely ending for people who succeed by that self-help model, because it is isolating from others and breaching of community. But particularly as you are opinion makers or teachers or value setters, beware of pressing that with others. We ought to be talking the language of self-development and stewardship of self, not of success. Enough for today.